Lobo Tigre, author and publisher of The Independent Speculator. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Happy to be with you, Tom.
Lobo, you always tend to look at the end of the year as a time to reflect on what you got right and what you got wrong for the previous 12 months, let's say. I can't believe it's the middle of December already. Of course, we're recording this on December 18th, just for a little bit of context. So looking back over this year, what did you get right? What did you get wrong? Did you think that we were going to have the run in the metals that we did? What are the biggest things that stand out to you?
Well, as you know, I resist joining the prediction racket, what I call the prediction racket, because there is an actual business of making, you know, hyperbolic pronouncements that get people all excited and sign up now. But and then the answer to the prediction isn't known for a couple of years. And by then, you know, the money's already spent, right? So I try not to join the prediction racket. But of course, as a speculator, you have to look forward, place your bets. But not to dodge the question, I actually just wrote the current edition of The Independent Speculator is called Hits and Misses. And it looks at this. And I think, you know, this kind of depends on what you mean by wrong. Like if by, since I don't make predictions, there's not a lot that I actually got wrong. But if you mean, you know, missed out on an opportunity to make money, well, then I got a lot wrong. You know, I didn't make any money on rare earths in 25. I didn't make any money on antimony or gallium in 2025. I didn't make any money on natural gas recently, though that's gone into reverse. So it remains to be seen if that for the whole year turns out to have been a good play. But yeah, there's some of those that I think I just missed. Like I was really surprised by the big move in natural gas. The other ones, and this is why I don't really count them as being wrong, like rare earths. I wasn't a rare earth bear. I wasn't saying sell all rare earths, don't buy rare earths. I was just saying this is a tiny market. It could be reversed like that if China changes policy or if Trump and Xi make a deal or something like that. So I'm just not interested. And so, yeah, I missed out. Was I wrong? No, I didn't say it was going down. And you know, similarly for other things like antimony or people got excited about titanium lately. You know, and the problem with these thinly traded markets is that, you know, a single major new mine can change the whole thing. Like this really can't happen with copper. You know, it's too big. And if there is a major mine coming online, we can all see it coming. Like these things are huge, billions of dollars, and they take many years to permit and build, so we can see them coming. Whereas let's say a private Chinese company that has a significant new, you know, tungsten deposit or something that can materially alter the market and pricing for everybody. And it can come completely out of the blue. Sorry, I'm going too far down the pathway here of oddball metals. But as an example, like what did I get right and what did I get wrong? There were several things like that I missed. I think one that you could count as being clearly right was I warned against trying to catch a falling knife in the oil patch. And maybe not for natural gas, but for oil itself, I think that has clearly worked out well. There are some people who have said, oh, Lobo, you were wrong picking copper as your top pick for 2025. Gold and silver, even platinum and palladium did better than copper. That's true. That is true. But I still don't think of that as being wrong because A, copper did it at all-time highs. And B, when I say, you know, where people ask me, Lobo, what's your top pick? I'm not trying to predict which metal is going to hit the highest because you never know. Like some one of these little oddball metals could just have a mine, a big significant one shut down and that thing goes through the roof, completely unpredictable. When I answer the question, I'm answering the question, well, where would you put your money? Where do you have the most confidence? What is your top pick, your destination for your own hard-earned dollars? So that having been the case, I can't say that I was wrong to pick copper for 25. And you haven't asked this yet, but I will sneak peek, you know, say that actually it's copper again for 26. That doesn't mean that I don't like gold and silver. I mean, gold and silver could easily outperform copper next year, or they could correct and consolidate for a while. Like if 4,000 in gold is the new 2,000, like it was after 2020. And even if you're a bull, you know, a period of correction and consolidation before makes the next big move up, Like, if that's where we're at now, it could easily, both of them, especially silver after getting closer to 70, right? How cool is that? You know, both could consolidate all year. It's not a prediction. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying they could. Whereas I'm much more confident that copper not only can, but will go higher. And so if you ask me, where are you deploying cash now? I have bought some more uranium stocks that fluctuated when spot uranium fluctuated, because I'm very bullish on that too. And I'm looking to deploy more into the copper space. So I think I've gone a little bit sideways from your question there, but I think gives the audience a feel for how I think about getting things right or wrong. It's not so, since I don't make predictions, it's more like hits and misses. And you know what? At the end of the day, for all the things that I didn't make money on in 2025, the important thing is that I did make money on copper and gold and silver and uranium, right? That's the bottom line. So, you know, if you need a guru who knows everything and can always tell you which metal or mineral is going up, you know, I'm not that guy, and good luck finding him or her. If you want somebody that consistently makes money, well, maybe look at my track record and consider hiring me to be your due diligence guy.
Well, I think that's the important part, right? Is the idea that, okay, copper might be your top pick, but it also depends on how you're actually deploying capital into that sector. And if that makes you the most money in your portfolio, again, there's just infinite nuance to any of these statements. But what are the biggest, let's say, structural positives for the copper sector going into next year that makes it your top pick?
Let me start by going the opposite direction. I can never remember their names because they're strange European names. And there's an interference. Do you remember there's a movie, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead? It's a play on Hamlet. You're not nodding, so you don't know it. I don't know how many people in the audience know it. It's very funny. And Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are these two like third tier characters in the back of Hamlet that are tasked with sending off this message, and they end up getting killed. In this movie, those two characters are the main characters, and the story of Hamlet is happening in the background. And it's a very funny, bizarre, twisted movie, but maybe I'm just strange in that way. It really stuck in my mind. So there's these two guys that put out economic reports on metals and mining stuff, and their names are not Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. It's more like Guildenstern and Rosencrantz or something similar. And the relevance to your question is that they're putting out a report. They put out a report and have promised a new report on copper, and they're kind of bearish near term. And they're suggesting that supply, despite major shutdowns, supply has exceeded expectations. And therefore, you know, copper bulls beware. What I'm saying is I'm aware that there's pushback on this thesis. I'm aware that the tailwinds that have come from electric cars and the AI build out can go into reverse. So I'm not just, Pollyanna, I'm not listening, I'm a bull and I don't care what anybody says. I'm aware of this pushback, but I look at things and for one thing, you can't model supply disruptions like we saw this year, and not just little mines, like major supply disruptions. And by the way, on those big mines, if a million tons of sludge swamps your production level, that's not something you can fix in a couple of weeks or months. That's something that takes your production out for a year or years. If there's a, ground movement or something like that, you may even end up sterilizing part of the mine. That area could end up being too dangerous to work in, or things like that. So this is a broader theme of mine. People, engineering firms and respectable outfits who may or may not be Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and they may still be alive. You put out this very thoughtful, clever, I'm not faulting the study, but there are imponderables that just can't be modeled. And, something like what happened in Grasberg or at Kamoa Kakula, these things, they can't be modeled. But there's always some. 25 was unusual in that we had more than usual, but there's always some, and these things can't be modeled. So my thesis is it's Dr. Copper to begin with. Like, I don't need no EVs or AI to push copper ahead. It's going ahead anyway. The world is electrifying anyway. There's a billion people in the world that still don't have access to electricity. Like, we need more copper anyway. And the supply side is constrained. I mean, even with the Trump administration, one of the most pro-mining governments in the West in many, many years, has still failed to, shall we say, obtain a resolution to getting a large copper project going in the United States. I see you smile to that one. You got my reference there. Right. So I think the supply side is much more complicated and difficult than optimists are really willing to see or embrace. And part of that is because a lot of it is, it needs really chaos theory as part of the analysis. And there's these unpredictable events. And the thing is, like, if you have a surprise in the copper space, it's always negative. You know, nobody surprises the market with, you know, 250,000 tons of production suddenly that we didn't know was coming. Oh, hey, look, here's all this new copper that we didn't know was
coming. Or that, the copper that doesn't happen. Is showing up for us.
Right. I mean, like I was saying earlier, it takes years and years and years to permit these things and then to build them, you know, a mine big enough to matter, to move the market. There's no way that can surprise us. We see it coming. Whereas, you know, suddenly 100,000 tons a year of copper supply going off the market, that can surprise us. The surprises are always negative. And you can't model surprises, but we do know they come. So my thesis is it's Dr. Copper. We need it anyway. The EVs aren't going away, even if Ford is backing off. What are they? You know, they're not just making more gas guzzlers. They're making more hybrids and those REVs or whatever. They still need a lot more copper, right? And the AI thing, okay, maybe there's a lot of hype and maybe there's going to be a lot of misallocation of capital. They're still building those data centers. Like, even if it turns out they don't need them, they're building them, right? And we won't know that they don't need them until, you know, after the next DeepSeek moment and so on. So I see a very strong base case. I see very strong tailwinds that might weaken, but won't go away. Like, even if the AI bubble on the stock market pops, that won't stop the construction of the data centers. So that won't, I mean, and I think if that happens, copper and uranium and other things will get whacked, but it won't actually change the supply side. That'll be a market reaction on stocks, not a reality, you know, on the ground. So I see supply constraint. I see the demand continuing to increase. And as we saw this year, I think just this year sort of pulled forward the inevitable, as it were, and the supply and demand. And we'll see. Maybe Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. I know that's not their names, but I'm sorry, I can't remember them. Maybe they're right. Maybe I'm wrong. But I think the surprises are on my side in this story.
That's fair. Lobo, what do you think about, you know, as you said, copper is your number one just because of the structural imbalances within it.
But it's the combination of risk and reward.
Okay.
So there could easily be more reward in gold or silver going ahead, or maybe uranium too, or maybe one of these oddball metals, but the risk is greater. Like, I have the combination of the greater certainty, lower risk, and the reward makes the balance there the most compelling to me. Sorry, go ahead with the question.
Well, I mean, that fits perfectly into what I wanted to ask is, you know, is the risk, do you believe, higher in gold and silver? And,
yes.
You know, we've touched on copper. Why do you think the risk is higher within gold and silver? Because,
okay, so let me be clear. I'm not saying that I think the risk is that gold and silver have peaked and now it's, another 5-year bear market, like 2011 to 2015. That's not my call. I'm not a bit, all those people that call me Darth Silver and all that. It's funny when I post something positive about silver, people say, oh, it's good to see you finally become a bull. When did you drop your bearish case? I've never been a silver bear, not in this market, not in this cycle. But if you don't say it's going to the moon tomorrow, somehow that makes you a bear. Anyway, sorry, forgive my rant. The risk here is not, I'm not really worried about a huge drawdown. Like, But if we have a correction and consolidation phase here, which could perfectly fit in with a bull thesis. Like if the thesis is this is the shoulder before the big head and the head and shoulders pattern, right? Well, that shoulder is never perfectly flat. And from the peak over 2000 in 2020, we saw substantial fluctuations, like plus or minus 30%. I think it went I think it officially dropped into bear market territory, more than 20% down, almost 30% at one point, like 2000 plus to 17-ish. Or so after that. And it took 3 years, by the way, of consolidation before the next big breakout happened. So that's my base case. And it's a base case of, you know, the path to the next big leg upwards, not downwards. So the risk isn't like, you know, you're going to lose your shirt if you buy any gold and silver today, or gold and silver stocks, the bullion. We haven't even gone into that. Brief aside, you know, the bullion is completely different. In my view, bullion is not an investment or a speculation. It's savings. It's cash. It's the, you know, financial asset I can hold in my hand for which there is no short. And I'm always a buyer of bullion. That's not a variable. As far as a speculator, you know, I'm not always a buyer of the stocks. Sometimes there's a time to sow and sometimes there's a time to reap. Anyway, so the answer to the question is I have higher confidence in higher copper over the course of 26 than I do of gold and silver in what seems likely to be a period of correction and consolidation. Now, if I'm wrong and they go vertical, well, to me, you know, I'm long, so I'll make money. But in the bigger picture of looking at this, I think that would actually be bad because I think that means we would be in the blow off top phase. If they go vertical again, if the next big move is immediate, it's now. If silver does go to $100 an ounce or more, triple digits, as some people are saying, not just, you know, I have no problem with triple digit silver at some point. But for people saying it's going there now, that implies the blow off top to this market to me. And that just doesn't square with my macro view. Like the debasement trade, when is that going to stop? Not this year, not 2026. I see that going on basically not forever, but until the dollar finally does blow up. And I think that goes on for years, which is part of my overall bullishness. So the risk to me is that people get all excited, pile into stocks that have just hit 52-week highs, and then we consolidate for a while. And the metals might only fluctuate 10, 20%, whatever. But the stocks will crater if the metals drop 10 or 20%. Right. So if you top tick the stocks, you know, maybe if you're really patient, you can come out whole at the other end when the next big breakout higher has. But you have to really have strength in your convictions there. And a lot, the typical person who is emotional enough to buy an all-time high is usually not the person who has the intellectual fortitude to bear through the, you know, bear market and come out whole on the other side. They buy high, they sell low. They say they're never touching them again until the next peak and they get all excited and do it all over again. So that's the risk that I would highlight. I'm not a bear on gold or silver, but I think there is a risk to people chasing, you know, all-time highs in some of these stocks. You know, what happens if the metals correct and consolidate for a while?
Well, directly in that, Lobo, what lessons do you think that we need to have learned or should learn from the 2011 peak? You know, there were these arguments that were made for gold and silver after the GFC that, you know, we're still in a bull phase where this it's going to the moon still. What are some of those lessons that we need to learn from that specific point in history?
That people don't remember history? that's not my original thought. But you know, it's funny how, let me put it this way. Never mind me, you know, tinfoil hat Lobo. Look at successful people. Look at your Rick Rules of the world. What if you've interviewed Rick recently, or if you've seen his recent interviews, he's taken a lot of profits. It's like people get all bent out of shape because I'm not saying silver's going to the moon tomorrow. But I'm not saying to sell silver. I'm not saying to get out of silver. I'm not articulating a bear market, you know. But I have said locking in some gains is not a bad thing to do. And I have done that myself. You know, I have one silver stock that it's really gone screaming up this year. I had like 3.5x on my investment, and there was significant risk in the play. So I took, so that just for round numbers, let's say I put 10K in and I had 35K sitting in my brokerage account. I took 20K out. That left me with 15K still in the play. So I have 150% as much money on that stock as when I started, but I have a double already in the bank. Like, you know, I would say cash in hand, except that I used it to pay off my mortgage or pay down my mortgage. But you understand what I'm saying? Like, I have a guarantee, like if the rest of that goes to zero tomorrow, like the project is nationalized and there's instantly no liquidity and I lose every penny I've left in that, I still have a double because I already took that money back off the table. And if you say, oh, well, but you lack conviction, silver's still going higher. Well, I have 150% as much money as when I started in that play. And so silver has continued to go on higher and I have continued to make more money on that. And so I started to say, you know, set aside Lobo for a moment, but that example just strikes me as being, you know, a number I can put my claws on is for what Rick's talking about. And so, you know, you imagine you're at a bar and your favorite team is on the screen over the bar and all your compatriots around you, you're all, you know, cheering for the same team. It is perfectly appropriate in that setting to be cheering for your team and saying, yeah, we're going to get the next, you know, next first down or whatever, you know, next whatever. But if you're a public figure who many people look to for guidance and will risk their hard-earned money on what you say and do, well, it's not the same. And if you cheerlead for your team, gold, silver, whatever it is, and people pile in at a peak and then get chicken out, you know, lose confidence and sell low later, you can hurt a lot of people. So one thing is, you know, you shouldn't despise the voice of reason for not being a cheerleader for your favorite thing, because they're trying to help. And the other thing is, look at your Rick Rules or beyond our world, the Howard Marxes, the Jeff Gundlachs of the world, these very successful people, or even Warren Buffett. Like, you have to take the profits. No profit is a real profit until you realize the gain.
You don't.
And so you can say, oh, you lack conviction. Oh, it's going to the moon. You shouldn't even think about taking profits. Well, you know, for some guy on Twitter to say that doesn't really maybe do a lot of harm. But for big investors who have a following to do that, but A, they don't. Like, if you want to look at what do people who actually have money do, they take profits, right?
You don't go broke by taking profits. And we're not,
right,
let's say we're not trying to engender a Bitcoin hodl forever mindset either.
Exactly. So I'm saying two things. One is, you know, look at what successful people have done, and you can discount me and I'm maybe not successful. I'm just little old Lobo. That's fine. Ignore a little old Lobo. Look at whoever you do respect, any notable financial figure who's made a great success as an investor. You know, they didn't get that way by saying, yeah, it's going to the moon. I'm going all in and I'm getting a triple mortgage on my house. Right? No, they got there through reason, discipline, including taking profits as they materialized. So that's the recipe for success. You may or may not like it. Tom, you'll get more clicks if I say, it's going to the moon. But if you want to help people make money, you know, that's the lesson to learn.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up that particular lesson in the context of this conversation and Rick as well. I recently got into a conversation on Twitter where somebody had mentioned that they don't want to hear about Rick investing and basically protecting his investments that he's already made, like protecting the capital that he's already made. They want to hear about what Rick would have done in his, let's say, 30s when he was more or less risk averse and he had time on his side in order to be able to capitalize on this. And I thought about it. It's like an interesting contradiction. It's like, okay, I understand that you want to hear the more risky side of things. What would Rick do if he was younger? But how do you divorce that from the years and years of experience that Rick or yourself have now gained through this market and understood, like, at one point, yeah, I had a 10x on this crazy silver mine, and then it went against me completely, and I ended up losing money on the deal. And, you know, on paper, I had this amazing gain, but I wasn't able to realize it, versus this is what I have found that actually produces or has produced reliable results within my portfolio through many years of learning these hard lessons. Because I remember Ronnie Stofferle telling me, we're not bottom pickers. We're going to leave that to the proctologists. Nobody can pick a perfect top. Nobody can pick a perfect bottom. And I think, you know, anybody that thinks that they are going to be able to do that is unfortunately delusional.
I agree,
but if they can,
19-year-old kid does have a point. If they have a different risk profile,
100%.
And I think, again, Rick has said this in his recent interviews. The answer isn't, oh, well, if I was younger again, then I would unlearn, you know, my caution or whatever. That's not what he's saying. Yep. What he's saying is you have the awesome opportunity of being young enough that if you do make mistakes, if you swing for the bleachers and you lose, you can pick yourself up off the ground and dust yourself off and do it again. You've got that time. Whereas a retired person on fixed income doesn't have that luxury. Though I actually like to say that 19-year-olds and 90-year-olds are in much the same boat. You know, when you're 90, your kids and your grandkids are already grown up. Like, you know, unless the nanobots come tomorrow and extend our lifespan by triple or whatever, you know, how much more money are you going to need? And you can afford to take chances at 90, I think, not with your nest egg, but with your, you know, with your disposable cash. The money that you might take to Vegas to go play for a while, you could take to the casino of the TSXV, right? Or the OTC in the US. So I think it is legitimate for somebody with different consequences for taking risks to make different choices. And sure, if, you know, if I'm 19, no kids, not even a girlfriend, you know, I take a chance on some big thing, some new crypto or pot stock or whatever, or meme stock, and I get lucky and I make a bunch of money and I become a millionaire. Sure, why not? You know, take a chance. Just don't confuse that with disciplined speculation. That is a form of gambling. And if you get lucky, great. Now, what my pushback would be, not that you should do different when you're 19 and you're looking for a chance. You know, if you like buying lottery tickets, I can't say that you shouldn't. But if you win the lottery, if you pick the right shit coin and now you're a crypto millionaire, don't you want to protect that? Don't you want to separate out, you know, a chunk of it to deploy wisely, carefully, for maximum gains with a reasonable amount of risk versus, you know, the high risk pool that you can continue to play with and gamble with and, you know, swing for the bleachers on. So I'm not sure I've wandered off your question there, but I do think it's a legitimate question. And I do think, sure, different marching orders. But the takeaway is the lessons that you learn in the school of hard knocks, they're not suspended just because you're younger or you have a different risk profile. You should make a conscious decision of, okay, I'm interested in the very high stakes gamble here, and I'm willing to take that risk. So I'm willing to set aside best practices in order to have a chance at this moonshot here. If you do that consciously and you lose all the money and you know that could happen and you're okay with it, I'm not going to do that. Rick's not going to do that. But I'm not going to say somebody's wrong for doing that. Just they need to be aware. It needs to be a conscious decision that I'm doing this instead of being talked into it by some guru on YouTube who says, oh, buy, you can't lose. It's going to the moon tomorrow.
Yeah, the other equally important part of buying low is the selling high part. And, you know, that often gets forgotten. And being able to realize that gain in reality is totally different than just seeing that opportunity and buying. It's just as important to be able to realize it.
Absolutely.
Lobo, before we leave this kind of like gold and silver conversation. I know it's been kind of twisting and turning, but I appreciate the conversation.
Best ones always are.
Exactly. Would a dramatic fall in the gold to silver ratio also kind of signal an end to the bull market, which is actually something that you don't want to see yet?
Right. Yeah, that has been my concern. And if you're a TA, right, you're supposed to be agnostic to what's happening in the real world. Just price tells you more than your best friend or Rosencrantz and Guildenstern or whoever can possibly ever tell you. Just look at the price, and it's the distillation of everybody in the market, right? That's the idea. But I don't want to piss too many people off here more than I already have, but I just can't go there.
Like, let's frame it as making
the real world exists. And I just can never concede that it is a mistake to look out the window and see what's going on in the real world. It's like the weatherman who has their theories and their measurements and stuff, and they have no window in their studio and they can't see that it's raining and hailing while they're talking how sunny and shiny it is, you know, not realizing that the radar is stuck and pointing in the wrong direction or something, right? So I'm always in favor of looking at the real world and the relevance to this right now, specifically for silver. I have been concerned. I have been writing about, like, be careful what you wish for. If silver is now in that catch-up phase, that is a signal of the end of the bull market. And as a fundamentalist, I don't think that's where we are. But that's what that would signal if silver is finally catching up with gold. And by the way, it has. You know, people say, oh, well, you know, gold's hit an all-time high, even on real terms, and silver hasn't yet, or gold's way above its previous peaks and silver isn't yet. And I think it's a mistake to compare previous peaks. Those are, by definition, outliers. Mm-hmm. But that aside, you know, you don't calculate a gain from a peak. You calculate a gain from, you know, trough to peak. So the last cyclical low was in late 2015. And if you look at gold and silver since that late 2015 cyclical low, silver has now more than caught up with gold. That has to be a concern. That is a red flag. Even the most diehard silver bulls in the world will tell you that silver lags gold at first and then more than catches up in the end. So if it's more than catching up now, how can you not? Like, you can celebrate that. Ooh, I'm long. Yay, it's going up. But how can you not be concerned that that is signaling, or maybe signaling, the end of the bull market? And so I have that concern. But my answer to it, the reason why I'm not selling my silver stocks, yes, I've taken some profits, but I'm still long. And the reason for that is there are silver-specific supply constraints affecting the silver market that are not affecting gold or platinum and palladium either, by the way. And I do think those will be worked out in due course. So I think silver is catching up, or has more. The gold-silver ratio, to your question, has closed dramatically in recent weeks, in the last couple of weeks. But I don't think that's because we're in the blow-off top phase. I think that's because of idiosyncratic factors in the silver market that are temporary. And so silver bulls, they don't want to hear temporary. They want to hear silver going to the moon. And I'm saying, well, wait, that means the market's over soon. That's not what any of us wants. So what I'm saying is, I think, yes, silver has gotten a bit ahead of itself because of these supply issues, you know, the London physical shortage and all that. And if that, or when that sorts itself out, then silver corrects and consolidates. And I think that sets us up for even bigger gains going forward, more than if we got the blow off top now. So my answer is that, you know, if I just looked at the data, I'd probably be much more worried about where we're at right now than I am. If I just looked at price, I might be selling, like just closing out some of my silver positions or even gold positions, because both of them after the peak would go down. I might be looking at a larger, if not wholesale, rotation out of gold and silver into copper or other things. I'm not, because I think that the signal that silver is sending right now is not a false signal exactly, but it's a temporary surge that I think will smooth out and will revert to trend, which is upwards later. So that's my hopeful thing. I could be wrong. It could be that we are facing the blow off top. And the one thing I say to people is that I don't think so. Like, I'm planning for a more staggered, steady climb up for years ahead. But if you think we're in the blow off top phase now, the way to play that is actually to buy the majors, to buy the biggest gold and silver stocks, the go-to names. And I don't need to name names. You know who they are. Like somebody, a newcomer to the space says, oh, you know, what's a gold stock? You know, what are they going to find if they type gold stock or silver stock? You know who they are. Those would be the beneficiaries of the dumb money that comes late to the party. The generalists just whoosh in at that vertical blow off top. Those would be the, that's why Doug Casey, my mentor, used to call these the go-to companies. When people get excited about something, where do they go to? They go to those famous names. So I'm not recommending this. I'm saying if that's what you believe, we're in that blow off top phase, that's how you play it.
Yeah. And it's interesting to think about the, if we're focused a lot on miners, that we want a longer, steadier, higher metals price for which miners to interact with the market to be able to operate in. And that's what creates a far better bull market than just this crazy blow off top that is, you know, on one hand, I understand it's super exciting, but to temper expectations and to actually understand what makes the money in the sector, I think is a more valuable answer, right?
That's a really important point, Tom. And actually, like the mining industry, frankly, they just flubbed it last time. When we had that big surge, this is another Rick Rule thing, like it really takes, you know, concerted effort and talent to take a sevenfold increase in the underlying commodity, gold, and turn that into increased negative free cash flow, which did happen. Like I've charted that. The industry took this huge increase in gold and turned it into an even larger gap, negativity in free cash flow. And I think that has a lot to do with why the stocks underperformed the metals this time, because recency bias, people were once bitten, twice shy about that. But now those companies, they are like literally printing cash in the sense that like they're mining real money out of the ground, gold and silver. And at phenomenal, like the quarterlies that we're going to get for this quarter, they're going to be amazing. You'd have to be, again, a spectacularly incompetent miner to not just make gobs of money at these levels. And, you know, people will get mad at me for even considering the potential downside. But, you know, I'm a due diligence guy. I'm not a cheerleader. So if we consider the potential downside, let's say that it's not just a shoulder. Let's say the worst case scenario here, and you asked about what do we learn from 2011, right? And I know we were trying to wrap up, but I think this is important. Like, let's say that we've just hit a peak. Like just right now, as you and I are speaking, it's peaked again. It's 2011 all over again. And the next thing that's going to happen is going to be a multi-year bear market for gold and silver. If that happens, you know, gold retreated about 50% over those years from 2011 to 2015. A 50% retreat from $4,300, $4,400 gold is still $2,000 and change. That is a price well above the all-in sustaining cost of most of your gold miners. I mean, it's a pretty crappy gold miner that has costs above that. If that's our worst case scenario, I mean, because gold's not going to zero. I actually did the math on this. Even pet rocks are up like 6.5 times over what they were in the 1970s. So if you say gold is just a pet rock, you're still looking at a huge increase. Like it's not going back to $42, right?
Where did you find a
two or 258, right? So anyway, I don't think this is going to happen. I don't, you know, with the central bank buying and all these other things going for gold and silver, I don't think we're going down anywhere near like that. I'm just saying, like as a thought experience, if our worst plausible case is something like 2011 all over again, one, the miners will still make money. Two, if you know, the worst possible timing, you top tipped that market in 2011 and you bought gold that day, you're actually 2x your money now. Like, so if you had the courage of your convictions and didn't panic out, you not only were made whole, you made money. And if you did have those courage of those convictions, you probably wouldn't have just held what you top ticked at that point, you would have averaged down, you would have bought the trough, and you could have made a lot. Like if you did buy the trough in 2015, you made a lot of money. So if that's the worst case scenario for people who get it, who understand these markets, you know, that's not the end of the world. But that's actually not my expectation. My base case is consolidation sideways with volatility, including negative volatility, before the next big move, which I do think will be upwards, because the debasement trade is nowhere near over. It's just funny that Wall Street has suddenly discovered the debasement trade that we've been talking about since 1971.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's also funny that gold, as the pet rock, has outperformed the stock market in that time as well, which
the CAGR over the long term is really, you know, sure, there's volatility along the way, but it's almost Buffett-like. Like if my favorite chart in the world is this one that we put up sometimes, like it basically the chart of gold since 1971, when Richard Nixon closed the gold window and the purchasing power of the dollar. And it's a giant X.
Perfect X.
Like that is a 70 plus year trend. And it's a giant X, somewhat curved, but a giant X. And I really think, okay, like what stock am I going to buy this week? You know, that chart doesn't help me. But in terms of understanding the fundamentals, I really think that's all you need to know. Like this is the fate of fiat. It's, you know, always goes towards what Doug Casey used to call its intrinsic value.
So Lobo, to take this back to something a little bit more concrete, looking ahead a little bit, obviously we know that Powell's term is up in May of 26. What kind of camp do you sit in? Obviously, Fed movements are very important to the metals, to the economy. Are you cautiously optimistic? Do you take that into account? How do you see this, you know, Fed shakeup playing out here over the next 6 months?
Couple of things. One is, I think all credit where due, I think Lynn Alden absolutely nailed the fiscal dominance thesis early before everybody else did. And not 24, but 23, and then bleeding into 24, I think I completely underestimated that factor. And, you know, I was one of the people who really thought we would get an undeniable recession, not just a K-shaped economy or a rolling recession, but something the NBER would actually recognize a recession. And I was wrong. There's one I got wrong. That wasn't this year. That was the year before. And this was the reason why. So, and this, the relevance to your question is, in a period of fiscal dominance, the Fed's policy tools are, if not completely useless, at least much less useful. Pushing on a string comes to mind, right? And we've seen this. I mean, right now, just as you and I speak, the Fed just cut again. And what happens to the part of the yield curve where people actually do business, right? Mortgage rates go up, 10-year goes up, 30-year goes up, right? They cut rates and real world interest rates go up. You know, that's not what's supposed to happen. You know, it's funny. I posted on Twitter about this backfiring. And today I've seen headlines about backfiring. So what I'm saying is not that the Fed no longer matters, that it's unimportant. We do see, you know, moment to moment wiggles in various markets that matter to us when the Fed says or does something. But that tends to be short-term noise. I do think the fiscal dominance means that the impact of those policies are not as strong as they would be. That having been said, both argue for the monetary metals. Like the fiscal dominance is inflationary. The weaker Fed policy, like we all know, whoever the Trump appoints, he's going to be a super dove. And, you know, we just got today these lower inflation prints as we speak. We got surprisingly lower U.S. headline and core CPI. And initially, you know, the market's been quite volatile on this, but the interesting thing is, apparently, I haven't had time to look under the hood myself, but I've heard from people who have looked. And apparently what the BLS did was that for some of those numbers that they didn't have for October, they just put zero in there. So, I mean, These lower numbers are very likely to be reversed in the next report, but by then the Fed may have made its next decision, right? So we're going into a near-term noisy phase, but regardless, you know, Trump is stacking the Fed to be dovish. So we're likely to continue to see more dovish policy anyway, regardless almost of the data. But the labor market data has been weakening. You know, the unemployment rate surprised in the other direction, popped up to 4.6% in the United States. And by the way, to our global audience, quick aside, I understand the United States is not the entire world. And yes, other countries do matter, but commodities are still quoted largely in dollars. And, you know, like it or not, the U.S. is still one of, if not the largest economy in the world. So what happens in the U.S. doesn't matter. And it tends to move commodities prices. So it's not that I'm unaware or just so U.S.-centric that all I care about is the Fed or whatever. But, you know, these things do matter. And they do impact or should inform our investment and speculative investment decisions. Mm-hmm. So long story short, labor market in the U.S. continues to weaken. I think the higher that, you know, the inflation beat is questionable, but the Fed has clearly decided that it's going to weigh more on the side of labor than inflation. And Trump's pushing that direction anyway. And then you've got the fiscal dump. So like all roads lead to inflation, no matter who gets in or what. I think almost regardless of the data, until inflation really starts taking off again, it's a foregone conclusion of more easy monetary policy. And as far as the, you know, it's not just a big, beautiful bill. Again, as you and I speak, Trump just announced $1,776 checks going out to the military before Christmas. The checks are in the mail already. From what money? Like we just had a government shutdown and we're facing another one next month because, you know, where's the money coming from? I don't know. We just printed. But those checks are on the way. And by the way, I'm not hating on veterans here or anything like that. I'm just talking about the check printing. Okay. That's inflationary. And so my answer to your question, Tom, is everything I see, not just in the US, Europe's rearmament and, you know, China's desperately trying to create more inflation. The only ones who seem to actually still be on the let's not have any more inflation bandwagon are Japan. But, you know, that's an outlier and they're having trouble. Anyway, I think all of this is extremely bullish for anything governments can't print into existence or loan into existence. And that includes anything real. But obviously monetary metals are a strong beneficiary. And this is part of why I believe in that shoulder consolidation before move higher rather than a peak. And now it's a bear market for gold and silver.
Directly in that, Lobo, what do you think the U.S.'s ability to actually create, let's say, a meaningful amount of jobs due to reshoring after the initial bump when Trump got elected from, you know, what do you think is the reality of the ability of the U.S. to make a meaningful difference in jobs from now, let's say, till the end of Trump's term?
I really don't know. Tom, this is one of those ones where I should remind the audience that I'm actually not an economist. I'm just a due diligence guy. People pay me to kick rocks. You know, what do I know? But I will say that there is a possibility. Like there is something to the fake it until you make it concept. Like it's inconceivable to me. Inconceivable. There's another movie reference for you, Tom. It's inconceivable to me that somebody as intelligent as Scott Bessent appears to be is not aware of the utter drivel that he pours out on a daily basis to reporters. I don't think he can believe really half of what he's saying or be unaware of that he's dodging the real issues with smoke and mirrors. I think it's deliberate. Now, is it for an important cause? Maybe. You know, if you gave me a choice right now, hey, Lobo, would you rather live in a world completely dominated by a one world government run by Putin or Xi or Trump? I'd pick Trump. You know, so maybe it's all for a good cause. I don't know. That's above my pay grade. But if that were so, and that's how you saw the world, like if these guys in the administration really think that this is the grand Game of Thrones that they're playing, and they got to come out on top, then that justifies anything. You know, truth be darned. So, and maybe it works. Like, maybe they get people going again, and maybe the reshoring happens, and maybe it works before Trump's term is up. The more difficult thing would be to have it kind of sort of working before the midterms, and that's looking doubtful, which makes it more difficult for things to happen in the rest of Trump's term. So I can't say I'm entirely optimistic here. What I can say is that the, you know, all these $18 trillion, $20 trillion, I don't know how many trillion dollars the latest number is that Trump says is being invested in the United States, it has not resulted in a manufacturing renaissance yet. And you look at the Empire State or the Dallas Fed or any of these, you know, the national business, like all of these things are showing, you know, with some volatility, basically manufacturing decline that has not reversed. So can they fake it till they make it? Maybe. Is that the right thing to do? Maybe. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Is it happening now? Not yet. Not visibly. Not in the data yet. We'll see.
One of the last things I'd like to discuss with you, Lobo, is kind of where you think the risk is on the AI bubble. You know, obviously, this is something that has been talked about endlessly. Again, it's a very nuanced topic. And it's interesting to try to consider all of the businesses and, let's say, logical leaps that if we protect directly AI companies, that then somewhat extends to all tech companies, all metals companies, as we discussed earlier. In a lot of ways, copper, silver, the rare earths, these have all had a little bit of an AI tailwind. So, you know, where does that logical leap extension lead us to if we start protecting and funding these businesses that have some peripheral idea to do with AI? Because as we do understand, the country that kind of wins the AI or the AGI race ends up becoming, you know, a lot more powerful than the rest of the countries of the world. So what are your thoughts on a very nuanced topic here?
I remember Putin himself saying years ago that whoever wins the AI race, you know, wins the world. And that's the way he sees it. You know, what choice do you have as the person across the chessboard from him, or, you know, the Parcheesi board, I guess, since it's more than two parties, you know, what choice do you have but to jump into that arms race? So if you're going to consider that a critical technology, then no surprise that everything related to it, including certain minerals, become critical minerals. It's really quite striking that silver is now officially a critical mineral in the United States. Gold is too, by the way, if you ask Trump. In one of his executive orders months ago, he included gold and uranium as, you know, called them critical. But the USGS hasn't gone that far as to include gold as a critical mineral. No, but if Trump sees it that way, you know, he clearly runs the show from Washington right now. So the connection that you're bringing up, I think, is real. It's clearly a concern. If the AI bubble on Wall Street pops, doesn't just deflate, but pops, I do think that that creates a short, sharp shock for everything, including gold and silver, uranium and copper. And I think that would be a spectacular opportunity. I know that, you know, long-suffering bulls don't want another opportunity, but Mr. Market doesn't care what we want. It's what's going to happen, que sera, sera. But what I'm saying is, if that does happen, and I'm not sure it will, for the reasons that you're saying, it's so important. The plunge protection team could just step in to make sure that it doesn't happen. But if it does, if there's a big waterfall event on Wall Street based around the whole AI narrative, if not coming undone, then at least, you know, winding down a bit, notching it down, then I think that whacks absolutely everything in the short term. And I think that is a dip to be bought for the things that matter, like the things we were talking about, the things that governments can't print or borrow into existence. And that's not just gold and silver. So I don't know what's going to happen there, but if that happens, I'm a buyer. You will see me putting my money where my mouth is on that. Bigger picture, though, you know, if you think you're in the Game of Thrones and you're trying to beat the Targaryens or the Putins or the whoever's, right? You know, what does that not justify? What lie to the public does that not make okay? Or what money printing does that not make okay? Or what intervention into the marketplace and even into individual stock prices does that not justify? Because we have to win. If we don't, we'll be enslaved by those other bad guys, right? So if those are the stakes, and again, I'm not making a prediction here. I'm commenting on human nature. When it's an all or nothing type conflict, you know, that justify, you know, the end seems to justify the means. And that's how people justify, you know, not just atrocities and things, but things that are relevant to us as investors. So that makes it dangerous to assume that even if the AI narrative starts unwinding, makes it dangerous to assume that that means that there will be a crash, because the stakes are so high. You know, I would expect them to do everything possible to stop that from happening. I mean, they would have to lose control of not just the narrative, but the plumbing of the system in a big way for there to be an actual crash. That would signal a failure on the part of the powers that be on the order that even COVID didn't engineer. So I'm not saying the market doesn't deserve, actually, an object, you know, that looks like it's about to fall may deserve to be pushed, a la Nietzsche. But it has been very dangerous lately to say, oh, this looks really weak, it's going to crash. I mean, in my entire career, the markets have crashed twice. In my entire career, there have been arguments every year for how crappy things looked and the markets should crash. And I can tell you for sure that clients, readers, subscribers have written in every year, oh, the market's going to crash. They're like convinced for X, Y, or Z reason, the market's going to crash. What do we do? Well, remember that over the last 25 years, that's only been true twice. So I'm not saying the markets will never crash. I'm not saying recessions have been repealed. You know, that's a David Rosenberg thing. Rosie likes to say, you know, you can't repeal recessions and market crashes. I understand. But the powers that be have a lot of money, and if you're in an all or nothing conflict, that justifies the most ridiculous interventions. So it is dangerous to assume that just because, you know, a market deserves to crash, and I don't mean that morally, I mean that financially, like overextended, you know, nosebleed valuations, all that stuff, like, doesn't mean it will. So be very careful of, you know, being so convinced of your own narrative that you take inordinate risk based on something that may or may not happen.
Yeah, question your own assumptions and what you're taking for granted in that prediction.
I mean, if you're gonna be in the markets, you have to have enough confidence to place your bets. You know, you can't be a speculator and sit on your hands the whole time. I get that. But you, as you put it, Tom, you should at least question. Like, you can't criticize everybody else's narrative and never look at your own. Like, that's not a recipe for success. Because yes, we can all make mistakes, even me.
Well, I appreciate the humility, Lobo.
Trying to help.
A rare moment of humility, perhaps, as you rightfully pointed out earlier, the arrogance that some people ascribe to you might be tempered by the moment of humility here. As we wrap up here, what are you most looking forward to in 2026 as an investor? And maybe as a speculator, is there a difference there for you?
Most looking forward to, I do think that the AI hype is almost certain. It is very highly likely to cool down a notch. Like, that's happening already. We got Chainos and we've got Ken Griffin from Citadel, you know, they're Gundlach, other people are pointing this out. So I think that's actually happening already. And that's part of the market's wobbling right now at the end of the year, is that we are cooling down the AI hype. And that's good. Like, because the AI race is real. It's not stopping. But if it goes from being hyped to being more realistic, like what are the actual businesses and opportunities in business and in this space? What is a rational allocation of capital in this space? How do we best proceed? You know, I think one of the best things that's happened in this year, 2025, was DeepSeek. You know, that reality check, that wake up moment, I think prevented, as irrationally exuberant as our markets may seem right now, I think it would have been much worse had DeepSeek not come out when they did.
It's amazing how long ago that feels like.
Yes.
Right? It's crazy to think that happened this year.
So what I'm looking forward to is I think that I'm hopeful that the market will proceed on a more rational basis and we will build like real businesses in this very important technology that will, you know, help us. Like we'll actually go from the hype and the pets.com phase to the actual Amazon that gets me stuff cheaper and faster than I can get it from the store, right? I'd like to see that happening as a person, as an investor, but also as a resource speculator. I think that's very bullish for my favorite commodities.
Well said, Lobo. Of course, all of your writing and your interviews and more of your paid products are all available at independentspeculator.com and of course on Twitter @DueDiligenceGuy. Lobo, it's always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.